Brilliant. Our chapter this morning is from Song of Songs, chapter 3, verse 6 to 5, verse 1. It's on page 680, if you've got one of these red church Bibles. Who is this coming up from the desert? Like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant. Look, it's Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword, all experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. King Solomon made for himself the carriage. He made it of wood from Lebanon. Its posts he made of silver, its base of gold. Its seat was upholstered with purple, its interior lovingly inlaid by the daughters of Jerusalem. Come out, you daughters of Jerusalem, and look at the King Solomon wearing the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced. How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful. Your eyes behind your veil are doves. Your hair is like the flock of goats descending from Mount Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of sheep just shorn coming up from the washing. Each has its twin. None of them is alone. Your lips are like scarlet ribbons. Your mouth is lovely. Your temples behind your veil are like halves of pomegranate. Your neck is like the Tower of David built with elegance. On it hangs 1,000 shields, all of them shields of warriors. Your two breasts are like the two fawns, like two fawns of a gazelle that browse among the lilies. Until the day breaks and the shadows flee, I will go to the mountain of myrrh and to the hill of incense. All beautiful you are, my darling. There is no flaw in you. Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Amana, from the top of Senir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's den, and the mountain haunts of the leopards. You have stolen my heart, my sister, my bride. You have stolen my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. How delightful is your love, my sister, my bride. How much more pleasing is your love than wine, and the fragrance of your perfume than any spice. Your lips drop sweetness as the honeycomb, my bride. Milk and honey are under your tongue. The fragrance of your garments is like that of Lebanon. You are a garden locked up, my sister, my bride. You are a spring enclosed, a sealed fountain. Your plants are an orchard of pomegranates with choice fruits, with henna and nard and saffron, calamus and cinnamon, with every kind of incense tree, with myrrh and aloes and all the finest spices. You are a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon. Awake, north wind. And come, south wind, blow on my garden, that its fragrance may spread abroad. Let my lover come into his garden and taste its choice fruits. I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spices. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk. Eat, O friends, and drink. Drink your fill, O lovers. When it comes to learning how to spot counterfeit money, federal agents in the US undergo strict training. But tracking down counterfeiters begins not with the profile of the counterfeiter, nor the profile of the counterfeit notes. Rather, the training consists of hours of study, of studying genuine dollar bills of all denominations. And the purpose is simple. When they master the look of the real thing, well, the counterfeit then stands out a mile. And today, as we look at God's picture of the purpose of marriage and sex, it's easy to forget how corrupted and counterfeit our world view of marriage and sex has become. And like counterfeit money, counterfeit sex, or sex had on the cheap that our culture considers the norm, promises fulfillment, but only delivers emptiness. Actually, it most often causes heartache, divorce, abuse, and neglect. Like counterfeit money, counterfeit sex will never satisfy. So this morning, I want us to spend some time looking at God's picture of sex and marriage. And I want us to be blown away by the real thing and the majestic beauty of God's design for it. So that we walk this world actually humbled by the way God views sex and marriage, and reveling in God's purpose and design of it. However, I realize that talking about sex this morning, which is the high point of this book of the Song of Solomon, will be difficult for many of us. Some of us here will find it culturally awkward because generations past didn't talk about sex. Well, if you think you find it awkward, please spare a thought for me, because my parents have made a surprise visit this morning. Sorry to point you out. Others will find that talking about sex opens wounds that we thought were long healed. It might be that we've been hurt in a previous relationship. It might be that we've been abused or manipulated or abandoned. But we have to realize who is writing this book and why he's writing it. You see, Solomon was not the world's greatest role model for marriage. In fact, if you look at it, his love life was a disaster. So he writes this book of wisdom from our level, with all its failures, with all its disappointments, to penitently tell God's people what pure marriage and pure sex look like. And to tell us to look up and long for a day when we understand truly what marriage and consummation will really be about. And therefore, this book, this chapter, is relevant for all of us, whether we are single or married, whether we've abstained from sex, or whether we are enjoying sex. And therefore, this passage opens with a wonderful celebration of marriage. And that's our first point, celebrate marriage. Celebrate marriage. It's interesting to note that the Bible begins and ends with marriage. In Genesis 2:24, we're told that this is why a man leaves his father and mother and is united to his wife, and they become one flesh. Adam and his wife were both naked, and they felt no shame. And that sets the pattern for human marriage forever. Marriage is to be exclusive between a man and a woman. It's to be sexual, and it's to be fruitful. The man and the woman are to become one flesh, and there is to be no shame about it, no naughtiness, no prudishness about it. But the Bible also ends with marriage union too. Turn with me to Revelation chapter 20, verse 9. It says this: "One of the angels said to me, 'Come, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb.' And he carried me away in spirit to a mountain great and high and showed me the holy city," God's people, Jerusalem, "coming down out of heaven from God." And therefore, I find it wonderfully fitting that almost bang in the middle of our Bibles is this wonderful book that celebrates wedding and marriage and union. We're painted a picture of a couple of lovers getting married, and it resonates with that marriage of Adam and Eve, and also that final consummation of Christ and the church. It sits right in the middle of those two weddings. And the wedding scene of our passage begins with shock and awe, a scene that's meant to take our breath away. Listen, in chapter 3, verse 6, "Who is coming up from the wilderness like a column of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and incense, made from all the spices of the merchant? Look, it's Solomon's carriage, escorted by 60 warriors, the noblest of Israel, all of them wearing the sword." The writer is getting absolutely caught up in the picture. "All experienced in battle, each with his sword at his side, prepared for the terrors of the night. Daughters of Jerusalem, come out and look, you daughters of Zion. Look on King Solomon, wearing a crown, the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day his heart rejoiced." Normally, we go to weddings, and the focus is on the bride and what she's wearing. But in this instance, the focus is not on the bride, but on the groom. As we go through this morning, I hope we're going to see why that is. So King Solomon appears as a bridegroom in all his splendor, just like God created the first bridegroom, Adam, with rule and authority and splendor, the high point of creation. And we're meant to be enthralled. We're meant to be caught up by this picture, just like the daughters of Jerusalem, because it's wisdom and poetry mixed together. We don't know whether this event actually took place, but what we're meant to be is immersed in the shock and awe of the entrance of the groom, blown away by it. It's meant to hit us and thrill us and make us stop and wonder at the glory of it. And what does he do next? Well, actually, we're told he just feasts on the beauty of his bride. In chapter 4, verse 1, he starts to sing about her. "How beautiful you are, my darling. Oh, how beautiful your eyes behind your veil are doves." And he carries on right down to verse 7. "You are altogether beautiful, my darling. There is no flaw in you." And he lists off 7 things in verse 1 to 7 about her. Now I know it doesn't sound flattering, because he says she's got the hair of a goat, teeth of a sheep, head like a pomegranate, a neck like a battle tower, breast like a couple of antelope. But you've got to kind of slightly step back and realize it's a poetry moment. So he kind of, I'll just explain so you don't go and try and compliment your wives again. You've got to put yourself in the passage and consider her, the movement of her hair, like a flock of goats down a mountain, beautiful and weaving. I don't know whether you've ever seen that. And consider the majesty of wisdom. Her head is full of wise fruitfulness. And consider the echoes of Adam and Eve's shameless nakedness. Her breasts are beautiful to him. And as I said before, there are 7 things in this list. 7 things that set his heart ablaze. Now, 7 is a number that's used in the Bible to denote perfection. So simply put, this song means she's perfect to him. And he invites her away to be married to him. He says this, "Come with me from Lebanon, my bride. Come with me from Lebanon. Descend from the crest of Ammonah, from the top of Senir, the summit of Hermon, from the lion's den and the mountain haunts of leopards." In other words, let me provide a place of safety and love, not like the mountains, but here in my arms, of security and family. And he says in verse 9, "You have stolen my heart, my beloved. You've stolen my heart." These are the words of a husband who gives himself to his bride. She's stolen his heart. He's declaring he's a one-woman man. She alone owns his heart. And it's marriage poetry. It's kind of like a moment when a bride and groom take that bold step of putting together their own marriage vows. This is a public declaration of love, a personal declaration of love. And on one level, this is a celebration of a wedding. But it's also important to be reminded that a wedding in and of itself celebrates marriage, which means that a wedding is not the end. Because when all the guests go home, when all the dust settles and the presents have been opened and the thank you cards sent, it's the marriage that is left and becomes the focus of your life. And it's marriage that ultimately is what a wedding celebrates. And culturally, we have lost the importance of marriage. Liz and I have been to a couple of secular weddings that were meticulously planned, lavishly celebrated, but the marriage lasted less than a year. And I remember one of the grooms at the weddings saying to me, "Do you know, Phil, I really admire your commitment to marriage. The bride and I have been planning this day for years, but we have no idea whether or not it's going to last." They'd celebrated a wedding, but forgotten about the marriage. So that is a human wedding. But as we're beginning to see in this book, there is a pattern and a rhythm. Because as we read through this book, we begin to see more and more, it's not just about a couple of lovers. It's not just about an echo of Adam and Eve. As the story unfolds, this story is also about Christ and the church. And a simple way of reminding ourselves is to remember this little phrase, this is about that. This story is about that promise. So this picture of marriage in the passage is a great celebration of that day when Christ returns to meet his bride. This is about that. On that day, Jesus will be triumphant. He will be majestic. He will be perfect. He will be powerful. He will be victorious and accompanied by a powerful entourage. And he will come down from the clouds of heaven for the whole earth to see. And everyone will be witness to it. No one will miss the event of that day. And everyone will bow down at his appearance. It will be public. It will be solemn. It will be joyful for those who long to see him. Because the bridegroom, Jesus Christ, will rejoice at the bride, his church. Because he loves her. He has paid for his bride. He has paid his life for her sin. He has bought her. He has cleansed her. He has made her his own and invited her to come away with him. He has committed himself to her. He has given himself to care for her and protect her and cherish her. Jesus rejoices in his church, his bride. The church is beautiful in his eyes. Do you accept that? This morning, as a church, a local church, do we understand the joy of Christ's return and the love that he has lavished upon us personally and corporately and the beauty that he sees in us? We are beautiful to Jesus. And you know, when we say our marriage vows, when we commit ourselves to a lifelong union that forsakes all others, we are foreshadowing the lifelong eternal union of Christ and the church, who forsakes all other gods. This momentary marriage is about a glorious eternal truth. And it means here in this church, and this as a church family, we must have a high regard for marriage. Those of us who are single, let's not forsake Christ's view on marriage for a cheap counterfeit cultural view. If your marriage has ended sadly, or if you've not been married, well, yearn for, pray for, long for the great shock and awe event which will be the return of Christ. And pledge yourself to his pure love as part of the bride, the church, till he returns. And please don't sucker for the counterfeit worldview that will try to convince you that marriage is meaningless. This is about that. And when you can immerse yourself in that reminder, when the world tempts us to say, it's not about that, remind yourself of this view, the glorious arrival of the groom and the glorious bigging up of the bride. This is about that. Therefore, to fall for anything less than that is just shallow and obsolete. And fill your heart with the conviction, this is not nothing. This is about that, and I will preach it to myself. And if we're married, similarly, our responsibility is to have a high regard for what Christ has called us to represent. Listen to how Paul puts it in Ephesians 5, verse 23. The husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, of which he is the Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit to their husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy. It means making the effort when the effort is gone. It means dying to self even when we're dead on our feet. It means being careful with words and attitudes and time. It means giving these things to each other and resisting delaying till tomorrow. Ladies, when you're chatting with your friends and they're running their husbands down, big your husband up. Because this is about that. And husbands, fight the temptation to be selfish. Let's not let the excuse of I'm too tired or too busy make us put our needs above those of our wives, because Christ would never do that for the church. This is about that. But our passage is not just a celebration of marriage. It's also a celebration of sexual union. And that's the second point of our passage this morning. Celebrate sexual union. What I mean by celebrate sexual union is that the church needs to start celebrating what God has given us to strengthen our marriages, to procreate, and to remind us of the greater truths of heaven. And that celebration is echoed by the friends at the end of the passage. I love the fact that at the very end, you get this kind of chorus of all the friends singing this song. Eat, friends, and drink. Drink your fill of love. That's what they say. Drink your fill of love. And just to be clear, it's not as if these guys are hiding in the honeymoon suite to surprise the couple. No, they're standing on the sidelines of this song. They've watched the public marriage of the couple, and they're celebrating that inevitable sexual union that happens between them. They're a chorus, if you like, that echoes God's good approval of this. And it brings us to the verses of our chapter that describe their union. Look at chapter 4, verse 15 to 5, verse 1. In 4, verse 15, he says, "You're a garden fountain, a well of flowing water streaming down from Lebanon." And I find it wonderful that just as the Bible begins and ends with marriage and sex, it also begins and ends with gardens that God has provided for his people to enjoy. In Genesis, we're told that God planted a garden for Adam and Eve called Eden. And in Revelation 22, we're told that the Garden of Eden is restored and the tree of life will never be cut off from God's people. And so the garden is a symbol of eternity enjoyed in pure relationship with Jesus. So it's no wonder here at the heart of this book about love between a man and a woman, he describes her sexual readiness as a garden. It's Eden imagery. It's reflecting God's intended context, sinless, pure, intimate, joyful, bonding these two together as one. It's not a coy fumble under the sheets that most people caricature Christian attitudes to sex as. She welcomes him into her garden. She invites him to have sex with her. Look at verse 16. "Awake, north wind, come, south wind, blow on my garden that its fragrance may spread everywhere. Let my beloved come into his garden and taste its choice fruits." It's intimate. It's a mutual climax of this book. He responds. The song doesn't scrimp on detail. "I have come into my garden, my sister, my bride. I have gathered my myrrh with my spice. I have eaten my honeycomb and my honey. I have drunk my wine and my milk." They enjoy this sexual union together. And just a quick explanation, she's not his sister, in case you're wondering. It's an expression that she is his soulmate. And it has a connotation that says this is not a casual fling. I'm having sex with my beloved who I really want to spend the rest of my life with. And their sex is fulfilling. It's satisfying. It's sweeter than honey. It's richer than wine. It's truly Garden of Eden experience. And it's totally and utterly not pornography. It's not a one-night stand. It's not cheap. It's not abusive. There is no We Consent app on the mobile phone to prevent date rape. There's no sexually transmitted diseases. There's no selfish masturbation. This is pure sex, proud sex, as God intended it to be. And it tells us that sex God welcomes and rejoices in is in complete contrast to how modern Britain believes it. Modern Britain believes sex is a commodity. So just like you get hungry for a sandwich, you get hungry for sex. Just like you eat to satisfy hunger, you have sex to satisfy lust. It's cheap, it's emotionless, it's dangerous. It ends with a wrecked and confused culture who obsess about identity, desperately long for stability, have no understanding and self-value, and have no dignity. But here is our passage again, and our pattern. This is about that. Because the point of godly sex is that it's not just recreating Eden past, it's foreshadowing Eden future. And again, Paul puts it like this in Ephesians 5, verse 31. For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church. Why does God enable sex to be so enjoyable and delicious and intimate and vulnerable and expression of love? Because that union with Christ will be so much more intimate and vulnerable and expressive. On that day when he appears, the profound mystery is that the two will become one flesh. I don't know the workings how. Basically, I'm saying I don't know how the artist painted the picture, but I'm still going to say it's beautiful. On that day of final consummation, it will be the climax of our lives. It will be the high point of our existence. It will be the end point of all our purpose and longing, and only eternity will be long enough for us to fathom the depths of the mystery of Christ's love expressed in that union. Can you see that in the Bible, sex is massive and celebrated, and the spiritual truths we preach to each other in abstaining from sex if we're single and having good sex if we're married are massive too. It's a bold message in this messed up world. It's a high view of God and each other in this era of cheap sex. And it's our message to preach. We preach God's design for sex in our conduct towards each other, in our abstinence, in our high value of sex, and in our church care of marriage. So can you see why sex outside of heterosexual marriage is such a serious offense to God? And I say that with love. My role is God's messenger. I say it as a sinner myself. So it's an invitation to all who are sinning in this area to come with me to the cross where we find our sins can be forgiven. I also realize that many of us have made mistakes in this area. And let me say once more, there is none here who can condemn us for our mistakes because we're all sinners here. Therefore, there will be very few of us who have not sinned sexually in one way or another, whether by deed or thought. So let's take our sexual sins to the cross and confess them to the lover of our souls. Let's ask Jesus for forgiveness and healing. And let's wait for that day of ecstatic union when our lover will take his bride into his arms and every tear will be wiped away from our eyes. And we will adore him and in turn be adored for eternity. It's a bold picture, isn't it? It's a high calling too. It's a wonderful future for us to look forward to. Until then, let's celebrate marriage as the good context for sex to happen. And let's not be shy about some of the things that we've covered this morning. I realize I've said a lot in the short time that we can have together. And many of us will have to take time to digest what's been said. But here's the point. Keep looking forward. Forward to the mystery of Christ and the church. Because this is about that. Our celebration now is about a celebration in the future. And I pray for all of us. I pray for all of us we will understand this truly and fully. So that one day, every one of us here will run into our lover's arms and rest in his glory and in his love forever. We're going to sing about our lover. We're going to sing about his work on the earth, from the time when he was born to the time when one day we will run into our lover's arms and we will give glory to Emmanuel. Let's stand and sing this wonderful song from The Squalor of a Borrowed Stable by the Spirit and a Virgin's Faith. Let's sing of our beloved Jesus Christ for his glory and remind ourselves this is truly about that. Let's stand together and sing.